Last week, Mike Bloomberg got into a bit of heat for stating he had several employees sign NDAs in the past. Quote, "None of them accused me of doing anything other than maybe they didn't like a joke I told," end quote, Bloomberg said at the debate. Quote, "There's agreements between two parties that wanted to keep it quiet, and that's up to them. They signed those agreements and will live with it," end quote. Anna Pacht, mother of all contracts, is here to change how you understand and leverage and negotiate contracts, designed for small and mid-sized businesses across every department in every organization. This week, I'm lucky enough that they've sponsored this episode. If you're listening to this episode, it's safe to say that you're probably a true crime fan. Some of the most evil members of society get off because they have the resources to understand every nuance in the law and in a contract. So click my link to Anna Pacht in the description, anapact.com/morbidology, and take advantage of their 10% discount, exclusive to you, the listener. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. In Augusta, Maine, in 2001, a little girl was found dead in a turned-over high chair in the unfinished basement of her foster home. Nothing reveals more about a society than the welfare of its own children, and the death led to public outrage, legislative hearings, and changes in the way Maine cares for its most vulnerable children. The case became a chilling reminder that it's a misconception that child abuse only happens in low-income families, and begged the question, what is the correct balance between saving a child from a potentially dangerous situation and destroying a family? It was around 5 p.m. on the 31st of January 2001 when Augusta, Maine police received a phone call about a child that had stopped breathing.
My 5-year-old fell into her head. She's not breathing.
She's not breathing at all?
No, I tried CPR and I can't find a pulse.
Police and paramedics arrived at the home of Dean and Sally Schofield on Skyline Road in Chelsea, where they discovered the lifeless body of 5-year-old Logan Marr, their foster daughter. Paramedics followed the EMS pre-hospital treatment protocol, which consisted of several steps for people who were not breathing. They performed CPR and endotracheal intubation, which meant sticking a tube down Logan's throat between her vocal cords so that oxygen could be brought directly to her lungs. While still attempting to revive Logan, the paramedics rushed her to Maine General Medical Center in Augusta, where she was pronounced dead. Logan and her 2-year-old half-sister, Bailey, had moved into the Schofield home, which consisted of Sally, Dean, and their 2 biological children, around 5 months earlier. Next, we will hear from Sally, Logan's foster mom.
You know, we fell in love with those girls probably that first weekend. These were our children. And we didn't treat them any differently than we did the boys. I mean, they were our children.
Are you zoomed in?
Yeah.
Bailey's big trick.
While Logan and Bailey were the first foster children of Sally and Dean, this was the 3rd foster home the sisters had been in just the space of 2 years. Logan's mother, Christy Mae Baker, gave birth to her when she was just 17 years old. She dropped out of school and returned home to live with her mother before Logan was born. When Logan was a baby, she was first taken from Christy's care in 1998, after Christy's mother, Kathy, anonymously reported Christy to DHS for bad parenting. Christy and Kathy had always had a rocky relationship, and they both argued about how to raise Logan.
When I used to stand up for myself, she used to get so mad, you know, and, well, then you need to leave. You know, one of those attitudes. Then I'd leave, and she'd call the state.
Christy's boyfriend at the time was abusing drugs and had stolen prescription medication from Kathy. While the situation in the home wasn't suitable for children, that was only because of who Christy was associating herself with. Christy had always tried to be a good mother. She kept Logan well-fed, well-dressed, and well-looked after. By this point, Christy was pregnant with Bailey, and she agreed to be a resident in a program at St. Andrew's Home in Biddeford. She took parenting classes and attended therapy, and in 1999, Logan was returned to her care. However, just the following year, DHS took custody of both girls after finding that Christy was, quote, returning to her previous unsafe lifestyle, end quote.
Somebody else was running my life. I was just the person following rules. It wasn't my direction. It wasn't my thoughts, my opinions. It was theirs. It made it really hard to have your own life personal. Angry. That goes without saying. I think it was more hatred. Logan started screaming, no, Mommy, don't let him take me. Mommy, please don't let them take me. I told her it was going to be okay. She's like, no, Mommy, don't make me go.
According to the report, these unsafe conditions included moving frequently, allegedly as many as 17 times in 1 year, and allowing Logan and Bailey to be in the company of two sex offenders, including Kathy's new boyfriend.
They went to court and they got an order saying that I was allowing my daughter around unsafe people. I'll take some of the blame. Sure, if I wasn't there, it wouldn't have happened. But at the same time, he wasn't supposed to be there.
The report also said that Christy's new husband, Paul Badger, had beaten her up in front of Logan. Christy had attempted to get her life back on track so that she could keep her girls. However, Child Protection Services didn't want her seeing her mother because Kathy's boyfriend was a sex offender. Christy had tried to keep away from her mother, but she didn't really have anybody else to offer her support. Logan was a bubbly little girl that loved the color purple and watching Babes in Toyland. Her favorite song was Hypnotize the Moon, and she could have spent hours just staring at the stars or playing in the snow. While she was in foster care, she still had visits with Christy, who said that Logan could always tell when she was upset, and in a bid to cheer her up, she would sing Pat Benatar's Hit Me With Your Best Shot. She was at one with nature and enjoyed going to the beach, swimming in the sea, and fishing. Sally Schofield had worked for the Department of Human Services as an adoption caseworker from April of 1992 until November of 2000, when she quit her job to become a foster parent. On paper, Sally seemed like the perfect foster parent. She had far more training and experience than the vast majority of first-time foster parents, and she had even participated in training new foster parents as a state employee. She had two children of her own, both boys, but she had always wanted a girl.
I sort of felt like if I had 12 children, they'd probably all be boys. So I'd never get a girl. So we decided to pursue adoption.
This really should have been the stability that both Logan and Bailey needed in their lives. But sadly, that wasn't how it turned out. The day after Logan was found dead in the basement, police announced that they had not yet uncovered how she had died, but said that they were treating her death as suspicious. Sally had claimed that Logan had woken up from a nap in a rage, and she placed her into the high chair in a timeout area in the basement of the family's home. She said that she must have fallen out of the chair at some point and hit her head on the concrete floor, killing her.
When I got home, about, I don't know, a little before 3, I guess, Logan was asleep. And when she woke up about, I don't know, half hour, 45 minutes later, she woke up raging. And I went in and asked her what was going on. And she just wasn't even responsive to my questions. I mean, it was like she didn't even know. She couldn't even tell me. She just wasn't herself. I asked her if she needed to scream. And she said, yes. I said, okay, well, then let's put you someplace where you can scream. Must have been over an hour. Kept going down to check on her, see if she was okay, see if she needed to go to the bathroom, if she was done. You know, did she need something?
Quote, this death may have been the result of a disciplinary action that may have been taken against this child, end quote, said Stephen McCausland, spokesman for the Department of Public Safety. Apparently, police had become suspicious when Sally gave conflicting statements regarding what had happened to Logan. Investigators continued to chat to Dean and Sally, as well as people who may have had contact with Logan in the run-up to her death. Logan's death reverberated in the community. A crisis response team embarked on Chelsea Elementary School, where Logan was a student, to counsel students, faculty, and staff who were trying to come to terms with the loss of such a young child. Staff remained available for any students that needed somebody to speak through their grief with. In March, Sally was arrested at her home and charged with reckless or criminally negligent manslaughter in the death of Logan. By early afternoon, however, Dean brought in the $540 cash bail and the couple drove away from the Kennebec County Jail. Sally was now on bail until her next court hearing. Dick Gribben, the bail commissioner, said that the low bail was warranted because it was determined that Sally was low risk to flee. The investigation was kept under wraps, but an affidavit would soon reveal that Logan had been suffocated.
At the end of the bottom of the stairs, and he said, Logan, are you done? And she was on the floor, still in the high chair. And the first thought was, oh my God, you know, she hit her head, she knocked herself out. So I picked her up and I took her out to the bottom of the stairs, laid her down, and I at that point I was just, my heart was racing so hard I couldn't tell if it was her pulse or my fingers. So I was at that point I was sure that what had happened was she had somehow managed to get herself tipped back and hit her head, and kind of knocked herself out or whatever.
In the basement, investigators found a high chair knocked over on its side, along with large amounts of duct tape with clumps of hair attached to it. Blood was also found on the basement floor and on the high chair. Investigators put forward the theory that Sally had duct taped Logan to her high chair and had taped her mouth shut, cutting off oxygen. Sally denied this and instead claimed that Logan herself must have found the duct tape and wrapped it around her body, before she finally admitted to State Detective William Hardwood that she did tape Logan to the high chair. She claimed that she then went upstairs to cook dinner, leaving Logan alone in the basement.
There are some things that we are able to see from medical examiners. There are some conclusions that we can come to so far. We can see that she was fully duct taped in that seat. And the duct tape went all the way around the seat. Is that what you recall seeing?
I didn't pay attention to it. It was just, I didn't really pay attention to the details.
And that's one thing that does surprise me, that she would be able to do that, to duct tape herself into the seat. And that's why I'm coming to you today to say, so if you want her to secure her in that seat, it's very important at this point that you tell us that.
And you know that a five-year-old girl's able to take duct tape, and especially in the ways you described it. So you didn't just type her in at all, just one roll
to keep her
in it,
because
it's there. We have the evidence that shows it's there.
She was talking about the duct tape, and I said, what were you trying to do?
It's fair though, that's the thing.
The thing is that she made them for some comment, and I said, what were you trying to do? Tie yourself in? And she said, yeah. So I said, like this? And then I did it.
Initially, Sally had claimed that Logan was unconscious because she had fallen and hit her head. However, when presented with the fact that there was no sign of head trauma, Sally changed her story once again and claimed that Logan must have become tangled up in the duct tape during her time out and suffocated. A forensic examination of the duct tape indicated that several of the hairs on the sticky side of the tape had come from Logan's upper lip and the sides of her face. suspicions had been aroused because of Sally's inconsistencies, as well as the fact that Logan's eyes had signs of hemorrhage, which was consistent with suffocation. The affidavit read in part, quote, Mrs. Schofield stated that she taped Logan to the chair as an attempt in reverse psychology to convince Logan that this was not what she wanted to do. Mrs. Schofield indicated she left this out because of the way it sounded. Mrs. Schofield denied that she left Logan alone while taped. She stated that she knew better than to leave her because Logan hates to be confined and it puts her in a rage, end quote. Police now believed that Sally had duct-taped Logan to her high chair and silenced her with the duct tape. At some point, while alone in the basement, Logan had tipped the high chair over, probably an attempt to free herself. However, here, alone on the basement floor in a tipped-over high chair, Logan had slowly suffocated to death. The shocking death led many to question the faults within the foster care system. According to a recent report at the time, Maine's foster care homes failed to get timely licensing reviews as required by state law, and that fire code violations and allegations of abuse within foster homes quite often went unchecked for years. According to Kevin Concannon, Maine's Commissioner of Human Services, Logan's death was not a sign of widespread problems within the agency that is supposed to protect the state's most vulnerable children. He announced that there was nothing in Sally's record as a caseworker or a foster parent that would indicate that she was not suitable to work as a guardian. In fact, Sally's home had been examined and approved by a non-profit adoption agency, and she was in the process of trying to adopt Logan and Bailey. An investigation soon uncovered that the last time caseworkers had visited Sally's home was in September, around the same time that they were placed into her care. It was DHS policy to make quarterly visits to all foster homes, but because Sally had such a long history of experience, it was decided that it wasn't necessary. Concannon accepted that this decision may have been a mistake, but said that a visit may not have even revealed any issues or prevented the death of Logan. Sally's arrest came at a very bad time for Maine's foster care system because they had just recently been under fire. Critics were alleging that caseworkers were underpaid and overworked and weren't able to properly provide adequate support that foster families needed. The state had also just been criticized in a federal report for failing to keep up with safety inspections. Shortly after Sally's bail, an ominous videotape was discovered. Kathy Badger, Logan's biological grandmother, had been searching through home recordings so that she could hear her granddaughter's voice one last time. She discovered a video from the 18th of December when the state had allowed Logan to celebrate Christmas with her biological mother and grandmother.
Can you hear them? Here they come.
I remember going in that room and just waiting at the camcorder. I could hear them coming down the hall.
Here they come.
Because it was my mom's Christmas present. Because she couldn't be there to see the kids.
Mom?
What?
What are you doing?
At one point in the videotape, Logan said that Sally would grab her by the cheeks and hurt her until she cried.
Mommy?
Well,
just so you know, stabbing on my birth mom?
No, on your birth mom. You mean your foster mom?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
She did this to me, and I cried, and it hurts me.
What did she do to you?
And she did it to my sister.
At the time of the comment, there was a supervisor hired by the state in the room who told Christy and Kathy that they couldn't question Logan about what she had said. According to Kathy, the supervisor told her, quote, that I was not allowed to distrust the foster family that was caring for her or any caregivers because she needed to feel safe and secure in her home, and if I did, then I would lose my visits, end quote.
It still stunned me what would make a 5-year-old stop opening Christmas presents. On that day, to say what she did to me about Sally grabbing her face, making her hurt, and her sister too. I didn't know what to think. I believed her, though. And I wanted to ask her so many questions. Why? What happened? I went to say something and I got a look from the supervisor. Like,
You know, head shaking, no, don't go into detail. So I kind of just kind of had to bite my tongue. It's like, well, let's try not to worry about that. Let's try to have a good Christmas.
Christy and Kathy called their lawyer and then the state police, who made a copy of the tape. Quote, "Ever since then, we've been replaying it over and over. I have never been so angry. There was no need for this. We thought foster care was there to protect these children. Obviously not, because Logan's gone," end quote, said Kathy. Apparently the supervisor had asked Sally about Logan's comment, but decided from the conversation that no action was needed. They simply concluded that Logan was, quote, "a playful child who told stories on occasion," end quote. One can't help but wonder if different action may have been taken if Sally hadn't been a caseworker that had worked in the same department as the supervisor. She was one of their own, after all, and maybe the supervisor didn't take heed to the comments because she felt as though Sally was a competent foster parent. In a world where anything is possible, it was seemingly too unbelievable that a little girl in Sally's care might be in danger. Therein lies the disturbing postscript to Logan's tragic story. 6 weeks later, Logan was dead. This wasn't the first time that Logan had complained about Sally either. During other visits with Christy, Logan had said that she didn't like Sally and that she wanted to come back home.
She would beg and fight with me at the end of the visit not to go back. I didn't know why. You know, she would tell me things, but I couldn't really discuss them with them or comment on them or ask her questions. She would tell me that the foster parents would wrap her and her sister up in blankets and grab her face. You know, she said that she'd get in trouble sometimes. I'm like, "You want to talk about it?" She goes, "No, I don't want to talk about it."
Days later, Senator Tom Sawyer announced that he would be seeking a federal investigation of DHS's Adoption and Child Protection Services. It was announced that state lawmakers would start their own inquiry into Logan's death. Following the announcement, DHS took custody of Bailey and the Schofields' two biological children. Bailey was once again placed into the care of another foster family, while the other two children were placed in the care of a relative. Quote, "Our initial thought was that having the father there to supervise was appropriate and safe enough. Based on some of the information we got from police, we changed our mind on that," end quote, said David Winslow, DHS spokesman.
"I told them that I would leave the house, that they didn't have to take my children. We'll have family come in here and stay with the children. You don't need to remove the children." "No, we're going to remove the children." The baby had never gone more than 12 hours without seeing me. And he had never even spent the night anywhere without us. And they took him, and we weren't allowed to see him for 10 days. And he was sick, and he was tired, and he cried, and he cried, and he kept calling for mommy and daddy."
Towards the end of March, Sally was ordered to appear in court for a district court judge to consider the state's request to increase her bond. Prosecutor Andrew Benson had argued that the bail was far too low for the nature of the offence. The judge decided to increase Sally's bail to $12,500 in cash or $25,000 in property. During the hearing, her attorney, Jed Davis, spoke on her behalf. He attempted to soften her public image by portraying her as a good and caring mother. Quote, "She's obviously devastated by this. My client has been devoted to children all of her life," end quote. He also read in part a letter from Christy to Sally, which was written before Logan's death. The letter read, quote, "I want to thank you for taking good care of Logan and Bailey. They are both doing well from what I can see," end quote. David and Marilyn Schofield, Sally's in-laws, subsequently put up their home for Sally's bail. Are you a podcaster? Better yet, are you an indie podcaster? Gone are the days where only the big podcasters receive sponsorship. Enter Podcorn, the easiest new way for brands and podcasters to connect. No matter how small your audience, Podcorn is simplifying every aspect of podcast sponsorship. You can set your own rate and collaborate with brands directly, and there is no exclusivities. As an indie podcaster myself, I absolutely adore Podcorn. This episode you're listening to now is even sponsored by Podcorn through the Podcorn website. They have an amazing marketplace to connect podcasters to awesome sponsorship opportunities, including host read ads, interview segments, topical discussions, and more. So click the link in my show notes to sign up to Podcorn today and start browsing sponsorship opportunities. Shortly thereafter, a number of emails between Sally and Logan's caseworker, Alison Peters, were made public. They suggested that the caseworker gave Sally preferential treatment because she was a trained social worker. The tone of the messages were chatty and conversational, like one would expect to be used between friends and co-workers. In a message from the 8th of January, Alison and Sally spoke about Logan's birth mother. Alison stated, quote, "Christy is still up to her old tricks, so she continues to make termination of parental rights easier and easier to get," end quote. In another, from the 14th of December, Alison wrote that she didn't want Logan's step-grandmother, Lydia Baker, to adopt Logan and Bailey, stating, quote, "They are now saying they want to adopt the girls, which I feel strongly should not happen. Lydia seems like a pleasant person, but given the history, placement would not be in the girls' best interests," end quote. With the emails made public, DHS Commissioner Kevin Concannon confessed that the comments between Alison and Sally were professionally inappropriate, but he still refused to acknowledge that the department's responsibilities are overwhelming its resources. Alison was subsequently placed on paid leave, but would be back at work again around a month later. DHS officials were pretty much forced to admit that other foster children had also not received mandatory quarterly visits from their caseworkers on time. However, they refused to say how many. Since they were remaining tight-lipped, the Press Herald decided to investigate and found that 19% of foster children in Aroostook County and 16% in York County did not receive their well-being visits in the past 3 months, but comparable information for the rest of the state was not available. The past decade of allegations about departmental failings and now a highly publicised death of a child in foster care had completely destroyed the credibility of DHS. Many were now calling for Maine to create a completely independent panel that would oversee DHS activities and review data on the outcomes of state efforts to protect children. Meanwhile, the biological relatives of Logan, including Christy, picketed the local DHS office and said they would continue to do so until they received an apology. Christy also revealed that she had sent a number of letters to government officials, including President George W. Bush, asking for an independent investigation into DHS. The veil of secrecy that the DHS had surrounded themselves in had frustrated the family, and they demanded an apology and an explanation. In April, a study revealed that Maine removes children from troubled homes and places them in foster care at a higher rate than almost every other state in the nation, causing stress for the system and a potential danger for some children. Coalition officers warned that Maine's penchant for removing children from their homes overlooks the foster care system and potentially traumatizes children, paving the way for emotional problems in the future. Quote, "The emotional torment of removal from everything loving and familiar is something that agencies like DHS constantly underestimate," end quote, said Richard Wexler, the executive director of the coalition. "Because of the burden on the foster care system, there can be lapses in oversight." Wexler announced that moving so many children into foster care can sometimes expose them to more danger, adding that there is more abuse in foster care than most people realize. Quote, "The more you overwhelm the system, the greater the temptation to lower standards, overcrowd foster homes, and reduce inspections," end quote. Finally, in mid-April, Commissioner Kevin Concannon apologized to Christy for Logan's death. His one-page letter read in part, quote, On behalf of the Department of Human Services, and in particular, on behalf of the many people who work with children and families, I write to apologize formally to you on the death of your daughter. It is my sincere hope that her loss will result in all Mainers recognizing the importance of protecting children in their homes, in foster and adoptive homes, and in group settings, end quote. Christie publicly responded by saying that she had appreciated his apology, but questioned his sincerity and said that it shouldn't have taken him so long to say sorry. Following the apology, Christie threatened to file a civil lawsuit against DHS unless they gave her a $5 million settlement. She characterized her decision as a way to bring about changes in DHS. Quote, I just want everybody to understand this is not going to happen to every other foster child in Maine. This has got to stop, end quote, she said. Christie's lawyer, Clifton Fuller, had estimated damages for a wrongful death, loss of companionship and emotional distress, as well as Logan's potential earning capacity over a natural lifetime, to be $5 million. Many felt as though Christie's actions portrayed her as nothing more than a financial extortionist. Whatever their opinion, Christie's statement was quite ironic, considering it completely undercut what she was contending was her central mission. If she wanted DHS to improve so that no child should go through what Logan went through, then how did she think that bringing so much economic pain to the state would help that? Practically, as soon as it was revealed that Christie planned on suing the state, Logan's biological father, John Wagg, who had been silent up until now, announced that he too was preparing to sue the state for loss of his daughter's companionship, emotional suffering, and lost income she would have earned as an adult. According to John's lawyer, he and Christie had their differences, but they were, quote, united in their attempt to rectify the wrong perpetrated against their daughter, end quote. He also said that he and his client had not yet decided how large of a settlement they were wanting or how much money they would seek if they go to court. Towards the end of April, it was revealed that a pre-adoption home study of Sally by Sue Kiefer, a licensed social worker for the Maine Children's Home for Little Wanderers, had been changed to a P Sally after she found that the report was too negative. The report also said that when Sally and Dean attended a foster parenting class, Sally dismissed the instructor's comments and disputed their knowledge.
I think probably the general consensus was that I was some sort of know-it-all, you know, because I would say, well, you know, I think that maybe we ought to look at this piece if something came up or whatever. And the instructors clearly were looking to me for clarification or for answers. And although I didn't notice it, my husband was noticing that there were certain people in the class who were just like, oh, great, here she goes again.
The state caseworker later allowed Sally to skip the other training methods that are required of other adoptive parents. As Sally's defense and the prosecution were preparing to take the case to trial, Christie announced the creation of a non-profit corporation called the Logan Marr Foundation for Children and Their Families Incorporated. It was designed as a legal aid society and would be recruiting lawyers interested in helping families stay together by representing parents and, in some cases, even children in foster care. The following day, the Kennebec Journal published an article wherein they said that there may be some appeal to Christie's announcement. They said that the idea of the foundation was ill-conceived and insupportable. They felt as though, rather than a good faith effort to raise child welfare issues, Christie's initiative instead casts aspersions on virtually everybody involved in Logan's death and tries to make her play for compensation appear to be more than self-motivated. In June, Dean's father, David Schofield, alleged that the state attorney general was blackmailing Dean. He claimed that they told Dean he should testify against Sally and threatened to withhold custody of their 22-month-old son. He also alleged that there was evidence at the crime scene that wasn't made public that would exonerate Sally. An attorney general spokesman denied all of the allegations. Not too long after the allegations, Sally's manslaughter charge was upped and she was now facing charges of depraved indifference murder and manslaughter. Depraved indifference murder is an alternative to the standard murder charge. The difference is that instead of the murder being intentional, it charged that Sally placed her victim in a situation that she would have known would result in her death. Quote, Sally Ann Schofield engaged in conduct which manifested a depraved indifference to the value of human life, and which did, in fact, cause the death of Logan Marr, end quote, the grand jury wrote. William Stokes, chief of the Attorney General's Criminal Division, said that the more serious charge had resulted from new information that was developed during the investigation. Quote, this investigation has been ongoing, and obviously the evidence is not known immediately. As the case was investigated, it was determined it was appropriate to present this matter to the grand jury as a depraved indifference murder charge, end quote, he said. Sally subsequently pleaded not guilty. In November, Christie sued DHS for $5 million after they refused to pay her that $5 million. She said that the DHS forced her into the lawsuit when they refused to pay. A preliminary recommendation of a legislative committee studying Maine's child welfare system found that Maine should do more to keep the families of abused children together and place them with relatives as opposed to strangers if possible. They also ruled that abused children should only remain with their families if DHS could provide the support services that were needed to keep them safe. In addition, DHS should not rely on the option of keeping children within their families as a shortcut to avoid addressing the many deficiencies in the system, including proper oversight of foster care. Children who are unable to stay with their relatives need safe foster homes. The pre-trial hearing for Sally started in January. It marked Sally's first public comments about Logan's death. She testified that police pressured her into answering questions, and now her lawyer was asking the judge to throw Sally's statements made to police out so that they couldn't be used in trial. Sally said that during the interview, she was in shock and felt numb and drained. According to the officers who had interviewed her, however, she came across as not emotional and she shed no tears. In that interview, Sally also admitted to wrapping duct tape around Logan's chest and arms, binding her to the high chair. Jed Davis, Sally's lawyer, also said that Sally was not informed of her Miranda rights and therefore her statements are inadmissible as evidence. The judge ultimately ruled that the statements could be used during the trial because they had been voluntarily offered. Waiving a jury trial and instead facing a trial by a judge, the trial began on the 18th of June 2002. Prosecutors would be arguing that Sally bound Logan to her high chair and covered her mouth with duct tape, causing her to suffocate. The prosecution announced that Sally had lied to police, first of all telling them that Logan had simply fallen over in the high chair and hit her head on the floor. When presented with the fact that Logan had no head injuries, Sally instead said that Logan had tied herself up with duct tape. Then when presented with the evidence from the autopsy and a search of the home, Sally finally confessed to restraining Logan. Deputy Attorney General William Stokes said that there were four layers of duct tape around Logan's head, possibly running from the top of her head, down around her chin, forcing her jaw shut, and another 10 layers of duct tape around her body and chair. Sally's defense would be claiming instead that Logan had died from a seizure. According to defense attorney Jed Davis, there had been records of Logan having seizures as a younger child. To prove that Sally was guilty of depraved indifference murder, the court had to show an absence of moral sense, savagery, or brutality. On the day that Logan died, she was being disciplined because she had told Sally that school was closed for the day because there was snow, when in fact, the school was open. Logan's teacher, Colette Gallenrue, was called to the stand and said that she had never seen Logan have a seizure. Rebecca Daugherty, who worked at the daycare, also said that Logan had never had a seizure. She also said that Logan seemed to have a wall up with Sally and that she had heard Sally refer to Logan as a, quote, demon child, end quote, saying that she was easy to love one minute and then disobedient the next. She described how in the months before Logan's death, Sally told her that she was enforcing stricter punishments for Logan. One thing that particularly annoyed Sally about Logan was that she would wake up early and wake up her sister and the Schofield's own toddler. With such harsh punishments, it isn't much of a surprise that Logan would cry for hours, and when she cried, Sally would put her in a timeout, which presumably meant that she would duct tape her to her chair in the basement. Rebecca described how on one occasion, Sally told her that she had sent Logan to the basement for 3 hours because she wouldn't stop talking at bedtime. Logan's therapist, Kathleen Madour, said that Logan was parentified and that she needed a place to scream and release her frustrations. She told the court that she had informed Sally that Logan would need to do this to release her frustrations, but Sally simply told her that screaming was unacceptable. Kathleen also told the court that Sally had confessed that on one occasion, she had wrapped Logan in a blanket to restrain her and then lie on top of her, sometimes for as long as an hour. Kathleen told Sally that this method wasn't acceptable and once again said that all she needed to do was allow Logan to vent. Sally eventually decided that Logan wouldn't be going to the therapist anymore, and Logan responded by crying and saying that she didn't want a new therapist. But Sally just grabbed her hand and dragged her out of the office.
Then she started with the tantrums. I mean, things like normal temper tantrums. Kids, you know, they get mad and they scream and they cry and they, you know, stomp off to the room or whatever. Those are normal temper tantrums. She really had rages. She would scream at the top of her lungs that she didn't need parents. She didn't need us. She could take care of herself. She'd always done it. She didn't need parents for anything. She would destroy her bed. She would kick the wall. She would beat on the wall with her arms. She would thrash around. She was out of control. She was... I don't know, she was responding to something, but not the situation at hand. And as a parent, your first response is, oh, what is going on? What is this about? And then almost the very next feeling is, who did this to my baby? What did they do? Why, at 5 years of age, is she in so much pain? What has happened to her? What demons is she dealing with?
The thing about dealing with difficult children is that there's a world of difference between book knowledge and actual experience. And there are all kinds of people who know all kinds of things about attachment disorder and children with attachment issues. And all kinds of other special needs that children have. But until you've lived with those children, you have no idea what it's like.
On the second day of the trial, it was revealed that the duct tape had been yanked from Logan after she was dead and then hidden in the basement. This contradicted Sally's claim that she had cut the tape off Logan around 15 minutes before she found her dead. Quote, "There are indications that the hair was taken out of her when she was already dead because there was no bleeding when it was pulled out," end quote, said State Police Detective William Harwood. The judge acquitted Sally of the depraved indifference murder charge, but decided to continue onwards with the manslaughter charge. The following day, a number of DHS workers testified that Sally had never spoken about seizures before or suggested that Logan had suffered from them. They all said that Sally told them that Logan had behavioural problems, but never mentioned restraining her. Probably because, as a former DHS worker herself, Sally knew all too well that restraint was forbidden. Dr. John Cooper took to the stand to suggest that Logan had died from a seizure. According to reports, Logan had one seizure when she was 6 months old, and according to Dr. Cooper, she may have had another while restrained to the chair, killing her. He suggested that whether Logan was in that high chair or not, she would have had a seizure. The prosecution refuted this and pointed out the hemorrhage spots in Logan's eyes, which suggested that she had suffocated. What were the chances that Logan had duct tape covering her mouth, which was obvious from the hair found on the sticky side, but had a seizure at the same time? Dr. Cooper had flown in from California to testify for the hefty price of a five-figure sum. Ultimately, the judge found Sally guilty of manslaughter. She was sentenced to 28 years with 8 years suspended. Upon her release from prison, Sally must serve 6 years of probation. As mentioned earlier, Logan's death raised questions about how Maine deals with vulnerable children. Christie asserted that the reason Logan and Bailey were taken from her wasn't because of what she was doing, but because of who she was. Uneducated, poor, and underemployed. She asserted that her limited social circle was another issue with DHS. She had associated herself with known sex offenders and drug addicts. Following the trial, Christie won back custody of Bailey. Her lawsuit against DHS, as well as Logan's father's lawsuit, was dismissed by a judge who decided that none of the counts involving DHS or their staff met the various thresholds specified in constitutional law to sue a state entity. However, in 2003, Christie was able to sue DHS for civil damages up to $400,000. The lawsuit specified that the proceeds had to be deposited with a third-party trustee and could only be used for post-secondary educational expenses for Logan's sister, Bailey. The money eventually put Bailey through college. The Logan Marr Foundation that Christie had planned on creating was never created. In 2017, Sally Schofield was released from prison. The same year, Christie died of cancer at just 40 years old. A sad ending to a tragic tale.
So when they said that she was raging and she was throwing things and that wasn't Logan. That was not Logan. It didn't make sense to me. I'm like, all right, I can understand temper tantrums. I mean, yeah, she's got them when she don't get her way. But it wasn't often. And these people are saying she had one every time she saw me. Well, what could be the reason she was doing it after she saw me? Maybe because she wanted to come home.
It goes without saying that the death of any child is a tragedy, but when a death seems as though it could have been prevented, then that makes it all the more harrowing. Part of the intensity of the Logan Marr case derives from feeling that if something more was done by somebody, then maybe Logan would still be alive. If Logan's birth parents accepted their responsibility to protect, care, and nurture their children, then maybe Logan would still be alive. If DHS didn't just assume that Sally Schofield was a suitable parent, then maybe Logan would still be alive. And finally, if DHS had listened to Logan's own complaints of abuse, then maybe Logan would still be alive. Logan's death sent shockwaves along with reform throughout DHS. But for years, DHS had been criticised and had been an unrelenting source of anger and heartache among biological parents and relatives. It was quite eye-opening that it had to take the death of a five-year-old child to spur comprehensive reform. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. Morbidology is up on Patreon and Himalaya Plus, so feel free to check that out if you want early release and ad-free episodes, as well as exclusive episodes and other goodies, including my undying love. I'd also like to thank everybody who's taken the time to leave a rating or review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening. It truly does help, and I am forever grateful. If you don't know by now, my new true crime book is available worldwide, Cults Uncovered. If you get a copy, please hit me up on social media so I can thank you personally and ask for your thoughts. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime article. Stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing Skimwalker, a true crime podcast. Until next time, take care of yourselves and have an amazing week.
Helen Puttock kisses her two children goodbye as she heads off to spend the night dancing at Glasgow's Barrowland Ballroom. Whilst there, she meets a young handsome man by the name of John. Throughout their conversation, John inexplicably quotes from the Bible. The following morning, Helen's body is discovered, strangled by the very stocking she had worn the night previous. The man responsible.
We are talking about one Bible John.
This is a Bible John.
This is called Bible John.
For this and other cases like it, I'm Jess, and this is Skinwalker. Search for Skinwalker True Crime on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.